California, please refer to the bios in the back of your program. Okay? It's an honor to be the moderator for this presentation. And I'm not going to stand up here and talk too long because I don't like to do stand-up comedy because I'm too old. So the most of my comedy is done from sit-down now. And so I'm going to go back and sit in my seat and be good until the end. And then I'm going to turn it over now to Magali, who needs no introduction, followed by Shelley.
Yay!
Good morning. I'd like to begin by thanking teachers and the bilingual teachers whose voices and whose experiences, whose professional knowledge and wisdom led to the development of this paper. And I think it's really through their stories that their presence and hope is felt in this room and amongst us, because they're important to consider within discussions about confronting equity and the preparation of bilingual teachers for dual language immersion and immersion in dual language education. Thank you to all of my colleagues here, Patricia, for inviting me. And I also want to add about my positionality. I think it's part of our understanding of where we are in the evolution of our work. And my work is really equity-oriented practice, research, and engagement in policy. And I think that those intersections are important as we consider the importance of the outcomes of this meeting and where we might want to go next with all of this. I think that I'm not going to talk directly about everything in my paper, but I'm, as I was thinking more about the comments in preparation for this, I want to talk about some of the things that I allude to but perhaps need to elaborate more on. And I'm also going to mark it all by the dilemmas that we face in both the conceptual and the empirical gaps that we face in the preparation of bilingual teachers and for dual immersion and other kinds of settings. And I'm looking forward to the conversation, the discussions, and the advancing of the field. So not explicit, but really focused on the social justice and equity understandings, undergirding the characteristics and the role that bilingual teachers play within the institution that's called school. We already heard and read from our excellent colleagues here about the importance of understanding how resources and the allocations of resources and opportunities for wealth and privilege are really played out on a larger society and how they impact the place we call school. I think that part of my work is also influenced by my 25-year history. I'm not Catholic. I was raised Catholic, but my 25-year history in a social justice institution which have very clear definitions of what social justice is. And that has really informed me and my work, and I think can be for further discussion here. So, according to the Jesuits, social justice is manifested by the preferential option for the marginalized, and exemplified by solidarity with less privileged and for those whom opportunities have been denied. But it's also coupled with this excellence in formation, and that includes the formation of students in pre-K-12 programs as well as in teacher preparation. I'm not going to get into the whole institutionalization of the Catholic Church and the problems that are inherent with the Catholic Church. We're not going there. But I wanted to lay that out there in terms of the definitional clarity that we need to seek in the preparation of bilingual teachers and in framing equity for our work that is here in these 2 days and ongoing. So the stance that I've taken is to intentionally keep using the term bilingual, not only because of its historical nature, but it's also of its stance in certification for dual language immersion as one of the program model types for which teachers are prepared, but also to disrupt some of the stigmas that have been attached to the term bilingual in California and across the nation and for our larger conversations. As you've seen, there's two major parts of the paper. One, the larger sociopolitical and historical context of bilingual education and bilingual teacher licensure. And then sharing some of the findings from our qualitative analysis of classroom documents, interviews, observations of 11 bilingual teachers in dual language immersion, as well as in SEI classroom settings, using grounded theories to inform the development of a framework that I hope can inspire our conversation. Some of the contextual elements of the paper include the review of national and state policies done elsewhere in these papers, but also in the landscape of the preparation of teachers, including a brief history of bilingual teacher preparation the compensatory nature of the work that bilingual teachers did in the early days of bilingual education after the Bilingual Education Act, some standards and competency-based orientations for the preparation of general K-12 teachers that influence the way bilingual teachers are prepared, and also just to underscore the fact that we do not know a lot in terms of the ways bilingual teacher preparation programs are implemented in programs that prepare them. As such, standards for bilingual teacher preparation are policy proxies as they are used for accreditation of teacher preparation programs, they're used for the development of tests that assess bilingual teacher competencies, and they're used in assessments for teacher performance. In most states, and in California in particular, bilingual teachers are prepared for specific expertise that are beyond and extend what non-bilingual elementary and secondary teachers know and are able to do. So these are added elements to the base credential. This happens in many other states. Bilingual teachers in any type of setting are not usually teaching in isolation. As we read, DLI programs can be a strand within a school, usually start that way, or are whole school models. They are prepared, bilingual teachers are prepared within the larger contested domain of teacher preparation. For example, journalist Dana Goldstein in her 2014 book, The Teacher Wars, a History of America's Most Embattled Profession, provides a historical analysis of the 175 year of the teaching profession. One that she, and I quote, says is the most attacked and admired in equal proportion. The history of teacher preparation is influenced by the purposes of Americanization and American schools, US schools, a question whose answers have shifted across this history, but still undergird some of the dilemmas and problems about equity in dual language immersion that we are confronting in these 2 days. Can DLI programs and thus bilingual teachers alone solely reverse the inequities that have permeated the history of US schools? What do we still need to know and do in order to prepare and support bilingual teachers to enter into this profession and to remain in the profession to address this dilemma? Contrasting the use of the teaching profession that impact the preparation and professional development of bilingual teachers, usually take these two broad stroke perspectives. One, as the idea of the teacher as a technician, that teaching is a profession, that's a vocation that is formed by learning technical skills, by doing them, and that they're assessed by standards, or they are learned by doing through the diminishing of licensure requirements and through some alternative routes. Some of the leading scholars who address this are also critical of the approaches and have also posited the idea of teachers as professionals who possess capital, professional capital, and are critical and intellectuals. These are the works by scholars such as Giroux and Gramsci, who challenge the tensions between the economic and ideological purposes of schooling, schools, and learning, and are not talking directly about bilingual teachers, but talking about teachers in general as critical agendas. So four agendas have been seen historically in the professionalization of teacher education in general. And they compete with one another, and they're still present in teacher preparation today, and in the context in which we prepare bilingual teachers, and in the context in which they enact their roles. The professionalism agenda is the move towards creating teachers that can meet standards, and that are competency-based, that are very narrowly focused. And there's a narrow focus on context. And these are then reified and legitimized through accrediting agencies such as the Council for the Accreditation of Educator Preparation and many of the state licensure requirements. Some alternative programs that is called by others the deregulation agenda includes the removal and the easing and diminishing of licensure requirements, which are manifested through alternative routes and the apprenticeship approach, which is manifested in intern programs. And many times in the history of bilingual teacher preparation, these easing of requirements have been responses to teacher shortages, and particularly bilingual teacher shortages. In the 1980s in California, we saw a great number of bilingual teachers who had temporary permits, emergency credentials. And in this new era of bilingual education in California, we're bound to see the return of the easing of some of those credential requirements, some of those licensure requirements in response to the shortage and demand for bilingual teachers. The social justice agenda, third agenda, is really about cultural responsiveness, cultural inclusion, sociocultural consciousness, and intercultural competence that's marked by the work of Jamila Gay, Gonzalez Molan Armenti, Joyce Irvine and Armenta, and Lansing Billings that talk about these social justice approaches. And the fourth one I mentioned previously was the idea of teachers as professionals who are critical intellectuals. So the study of teacher practices and perspectives that are required of us together about what it means to learn and teach in dual language immersion classrooms are also informed by some empirical and conceptual research by teacher education scholars such as Etta Hollins, and also by Ken Zeichner, who I cite in terms of the framing for the study about how do we capture knowledge and practice for bilingual teachers. Hollins contends that learning to teach, and therefore the requirements in teacher preparation programs and bilingual teacher educators, the integration of academic knowledge and experience for teaching practice in authentic contexts guided by a theoretical perspective and a philosophical stance. So this is the work that's coming and influencing us as bilingual teacher educators and those who study bilingual teacher preparation that resonate and are potential allies for us to work with as well. The framework that Collins promotes is a move towards greater professionalism by having this theoretical stance and experiences in teacher preparation that provides not just academic knowledge, but directed observation, guided practice, and supports through focused inquiry of teachers in practice guided by more expert others. It's a sociocultural approach to learning to teach. It's within this context that the teachers in this study allowed me to enter into their classrooms to review and discuss the work that they have produced, the products of their teaching, through the proposition of this framework that hopefully allows us to enter into conversations about moving towards greater professionalization in the profession that moves beyond standards. Standards will not go away. They are a reality. But one of the things that I think that we can continue to discuss in our conversations is that how do we move forward the discussions around equity even within standards? And there's some very interesting political dynamics that are going on that are alluded to in the paper, but I think that some of my scholars who are present in this room can best add to that in the conversation, portion of our conversation. So the bilingual teaching epistemologies, bilingual epistemological framework for teaching that I'm proposing here, are generated by observed practices and interpretation of practices through the grounded theoretical method that I discussed in my paper. And these are four big elements that I think that bear further scrutiny and further discussion and further testing in our field of later empirical work. So the notion of multilingual pedagogic content knowledge is something that's also not new, but is applied here through the long time work of John Schumann from 1972 that proposed a teaching pedagogic framework that talked about language and content. And I'm adding to that based on the evidence that you saw through the narratives of the teachers, through the experiences and the synopses of their practices and their interview data about how critical approaches to multi-literacy development was also instantiated. The second notion of cross-cultural capital, and I really like Ana Hernandez's framing of cross-cultural equity as a clearer instantiation of what the observations and the data told me about the practices of these 11 teachers that address multiple forms of capital, address the intersectionality of who our teachers are in the communities in which they're teaching, and the families that they engage with. So the bilingual teachers that I interacted with in these interviews and analyses recognized the complexity of power relations, recognized their own privilege, and recognized that in the challenges that they had with gentrification, that they needed to move the agenda beyond their classrooms to the larger community context. The third element, translinguistic repertoires, involve mostly the use of language. They involve informal and formal uses of standard and non-standard languages. So we've already talked about the fact that Latino communities are not homogeneous, that they represent different identities, different countries of origin, and different language usage and dialects of those languages within those languages. The teachers observed were engaging in the ability to interact informally with parents and with students, and also formally to be able to reach the target goals of standard language instruction in those allocated times of the day. I want to refer to some of the earlier work that was really instrumental that Guadalupe also addressed in a book, which was about teaching Hispanohablantes, Spanish-speaking students, and the normas lingüísticas, the linguistic norms that we perceive as Latino speakers as preferential or less preferential, and that those dynamics are also at play, and that we need to also prepare teachers to understand and to utilize and to value non-standard varieties of the languages and the interactions that they have, while simultaneously reaching the goals of performance and outcomes in the standardized languages. So those formal and informal language and translinguistic repertoires are evolving, are very difficult to capture because they happen in the micro interactions of instructional moments and non-instructional moments. They happen in the playgrounds, they happen with informal conversations with families, and we need to expand the notion of translanguaging, just to have these binary notions, Spanish and English, to include translinguistic repertoires. We've also addressed critical consciousness repeatedly in our conversations, and the surfacing of the idea of teachers as cultural workers that comes from Freire's work. So critical consciousness is actually an important element of Freire's work in critical pedagogy, but it's the beginning. So these ideas of reflection as those moments of understanding, knowing the histories, knowing the lived realities of the students and their communities and their families, is one part of it. But what these teachers were also able to manifest was this idea of action, that they were able to take it a step further, that they were able to engage. In the case of Vivian, I want to be able to use the right pseudonyms because I know all these teachers, who really did an analysis of the social studies curriculum with her students. She had her students do this analysis. And that led to a change in California state law recently that really was the incorporation of a fact, of a historical event, that really was an oppressive act, a historical act that raised the consciousness of the entire state, but that happened in one classroom. So the idea of critical consciousness is an important facet, but what these teachers also enacted was critical agencies. These elements are interwoven, they're not self-standing, it's not a linear framework, but it's beginning to look at those practices that are epistemic, that really mark the qualities of our bilingual teachers and the practices of bilingual teachers that can move the equity agenda forward. A couple of other examples that come from the work was Stacy. Stacy is in a school that is in a district, in a large urban school district, that not far from here, that was facing the kind of closures that were mentioned in earlier papers, right? It was decreasing enrollment, it's a working class community, that experienced a gentrification, and where in the beginning of her career, she really wanted to uplift cultural traditions in a predominant Latino community, she shifted from that to really begin to think about this beyond the heroes and holidays approach, but also to think about how to raise the consciousness of the communities that were there, the white middle-class communities who were coming into the school, who were contributing to the gentrification, who were shifting the power dynamics in the school. And she decided to continue the use of the visual and performing arts, but to have the students do the play Hamilton. And that became a beginning of a conversation of historical issues in race, power, and privilege that engaged the entire school community beyond her classroom. Bilingual epistemologies, the way that are being defined here, are bilingual epistemology for teaching refer to the evidence that I found from these 11 teachers, unlimited base for sure, to be sure, that really portray their perspectives and practices and that represent their choices for their approaches to teaching languages, to teaching content, and about their corresponding representation of their beliefs about the student populations that they're teaching. So epistemology refers to not only what teachers represent about what counts as knowledge, but also how they organize knowledge and how they organize pedagogy through their how they organize knowledge through their practices. What I'm most excited about in this conversation is really about, so some of these things I've said in my paper and some of the things I haven't said in my paper, but it really allows us to elaborate and move further in these three areas, research, policy, and practice. It's already been mentioned that we need a greater research base for what bilingual teachers and DLI need to know, how they understand it, and how their practices represent equity for students. We need to also move beyond the binary of this idea of who are researchers and who are activists. I think we can be both. I think we can be advocates and advocacy-oriented researchers who use the talents and skills for which we've been trained to tell our stories better, to break down some of those barriers about quantitative versus qualitative research, and create a more robust research agenda that also includes equity clearly. We need more research in bilingual teacher education preparation, and particularly across the nation as standards vary quite broadly. We also have really not examined the role of the role of bilingual teacher education faculty in bilingual teacher preparation programs. A growing body of research really talks about some of the trials and tribulations, particularly in restrictive language moments, historical moments in time, in the 227 era. And some of the teachers, in fact, who were in this study really were bilingually certified teachers in SCI classrooms. And one of the key points about that is that there are many of those teachers who really identify themselves as a bilingual teacher, regardless of the type of program that they're in. And I think that really underscores some of the comments that were made earlier about we cannot hang our hats on dual language immersion as the only kind of program, or 90-10 even as the only kind of program. And we need to look at the role of faculty that they have in providing those experiences for in bilingual teacher preparation, those clinical experiences in bilingual teacher education that provides them opportunities and exposure to a variety type of program, including DLI, but not limited. In addition, we also need observation tools and instruments. So this is another feature that is plaguing teacher education today. Because of many accreditation standards and the political push and critique of bilingual teacher preparation, largely, accreditation has also required us to have valid and reliable assessments. Valid and reliable assessment observational tools for teachers in practice. And some teacher evaluation systems also incorporate them, state-level teacher evaluation systems. But very few of those observation tools, or none that I can find, really are robust enough, conceptually clear enough, nor vetted by the bilingual teacher professionals together with research to be able to describe fully equity situations and equity practices in DLI and other types of bilingual programs. From a policy perspective, in terms of bilingual teacher preparation policies, if equity is to be an outcome, an input, and a process within dual language immersion, then the role of equity in initial teacher preparation, in the initial preparation of bilingual teachers, as well as a variety of bilingual program designs, must include equity as an philosophical, and epistemological basis for the profession. Current state licensure requirements are largely silent on the issue of equity, as in the case of the current bilingual teacher preparation programs for California, where the word equity is only found in one of the references, it's not in the content of the standards, and is a citation to one of your earlier works. That's easy. I think an unstated policy issue that we need to discuss is also about the professionalization and the recognition of the work and the effort and the labor of bilingual teacher workforce through adequate compensation. We're in the midst of a very contested labor union potential strike in LA Unified, and I'm not sure how the work of bilingual teachers is being fully represented, both in the types of programs that they're teaching in, and also in the work that they do in non-bilingual programs. So if you are a bilingually authorized teacher, as you saw in some of the cases, they're using their skills, they're using their practices, they're using their agency in those SEI classrooms, and that's what sustains them as bilingual educators and has sustained them in the profession. In regards to practice and continued work in practice through the exploration of bilingual epistemological frameworks for teaching such as this, we also know that as a general teacher development, that expertise develops over time with bilingual teachers. And we don't fully know the conditions under which bilingual teachers are retained and how they're influenced by factors such as the kind of support that they get in their classroom, the kind of mentoring, particularly in the first 2 years of their practice. We also need to know more about the type of ongoing professional development that allows them to implement and instantiate practices that are specifically focused within their context and contexts that are authentic to them and they're not all DLI contexts. And then we also know that the retention of bilingual teachers is influenced by school climate and culture. And we've heard a lot about school climate and culture and community climate and culture, because we know that teacher socialization begins as soon as they enter their school, their classroom door, and the best teacher preparation program is only the beginning for the development of bilingual teacher expertise over time. And thus, we need to look at further work at the moments, the career moments in teacher expertise at the novice level, at the intermediate level or mid-career level that I talk here, and also at the expert level. And some of the veteran teachers who have been through, even some of the mid-career teachers whose stories you read about here, have really been through the trenches during the post-227 era, and only now are being recognized as another potential pool of bilingual teachers, and they will require additional support as well. So with those three conclusions, I think I want to stop now. I really am excited to enter into the conversation with all of you, and I turn it out over to Shelley.
Well, good morning, everybody. As I have been listening to everybody since yesterday, and I look around the room and I know very few of you, which is unusual for me to be in a conversation about bilingual education and not know too many people in the room, right? I wonder why Patricia had me standing up here talking to all of you researchers, and I know why with Magali, because she and I do a lot of work together. So what I'm going to say probably is a little different than what you've been hearing from other folks, but bear with me, okay? Bear with me. So I do want to set a little context for California for all of us. As you know, we passed 20 years ago Proposition 227, which, you know, basically undid all of our bilingual programs. Here we are 20 years later, and in November 2016, we passed another proposition that basically undid 227. But what about that passage was so significant for us was it passed with 73.5% of the electorate voting yes. On the ballot, it said English proficiency, multilingual education. So voters saw what they were voting for. It didn't just say, you know, good things for all kids. I mean, it was up there, right? In the title, right? It passed in every county of our state. So no matter where you live, it passed, right? So, you know, we go around saying we have a mandate. You know, that's our perspective. We have a mandate from the public, right? And then right after the passage of Prop 58, our state superintendent of public instruction, who's been a champion for us, called together a group of educators to develop what we call an English Learner Roadmap. The roadmap is really new policy. It's a new state policy for educating English learners. We have never in California had a policy that looks at what we think is good for English learners in this state, pre-K through 12th grade. That was adopted unanimously by our Board of Education in July 2017. We have legislation, we have policy, we have public support. And then we had our state superintendent this last May come up with an initiative of his own called Global California 2030. I know it has the global word in it, but we've got to go with it. Let's not diss it because it says global. We have Global California 2030. And he sets aspirational benchmarks for the amount of bilingual teachers we want to get certified, for the amount of dual immersion programs we want to increase in the state, for the amount of students who should be getting the seal of biliteracy. I mean, he sets aspirational goals and challenges school districts to set their own, parallel to the, I mean, he's like, you know, 6 months out the door. He's setting this initiative, Global 2030, right? And so we as educators and advocates and researchers in California are saying, we gotta go with this. We have an opportunity here. While this is on our plate, we have to move the agenda, right? And so after the passage of Prop 58, our organization and CAVE pulled together all the major education organizations in the state to discuss what would it mean to implement Proposition 58? What do we need? What would it mean? And it was unanimous. It was a short discussion. The discussion was, we need to do something about the shortage of bilingual teachers, which brings me to our panel today, right? And so the question for us is, the linchpin, at least from my perspective, is the quality of the instruction and the program in the classroom, which is going to determine the quality of the program. We have to do what Catherine said in her article. We have to make sure all those structures are in place and we attend to those. But we could put those all in place and attend to them. If we have bad instruction in the classroom, it's not going to be good for our children, for any children that are sitting in those classrooms. So the quality of instruction is for us a key issue in terms of being able to actualize what we hope we want for all of our students, right? Now, what's important for me in terms of Magali's paper is that she's taken the courageous effort to come up with a framework, right, about what that preparation ought to be and what teachers ought to know and be able to deliver in terms of quality program. And I know she's put that out there as a proposal, and when we were talking, she goes, well, what do you think? Do you think it's usable? Do you think it'll contribute to anything? I go, absolutely, it's the beginning of the conversation, because when we decided that the shortage of bilingual teachers was the issue, everybody said, well, what's out there? Do we know how many bilingual teachers we have in California? I mean, what is the shortage, right? And so we decided to do a study, right?
A survey.
Thank you. We decided to do a survey that ended up in a study on who's out there. Because we had hundreds of bilingual, and now we know thousands of bilingual teachers sitting in English-only classrooms, thousands, right? And we have a lot of teachers who are bilingual who never went to get their bilingual certification. ¿Por qué? I mean, there was no need for them, right? So the question is, how many? So we teamed up with our State Teachers Association and our State Administrators Association, and we had a survey sent out to every SUP and every HR person, one survey. We had another survey sent out to every teacher through the Teachers Association. And what we wanted to find out from the districts is, okay, so how many teachers do you have sitting in English-only classrooms or, you know, are bilingual and don't have certification? And what's your shortage? Do you think you have a shortage, right? And from the teachers who wanted to know, okay, so if you're bilingual, are you willing to come back? And what would it take for you to come back, right? And so I brought a copy of the results of that for everybody. But just salient points in that were, believe it or not, 111 districts responded to us. Just in the 111 districts, over 6,000 bilingual teachers were sitting in English-only classrooms. Wow. Another 900 teachers are bilingual and don't have certification. And the districts themselves, if you look at extreme to modest shortage, constituted 86% of the districts. So they're all reporting shortage, but there's a supply. They may not be in the same places, right? They may not be in the same places, but many are, right? So the teachers, are you willing to come back? 82% said yes. But then we said, what would it take for you to feel confident to come back, right? Mm-hmm. And in all honesty, they want money. They want it. And you know, we have to recognize they do more work. They are now sitting in English classrooms. They used to be in bilingual. They know the difference. And so they need to be compensated, right? So that, I have to say, that was number one. But number two was professional development. They recognize they need to be current. They need to have a larger repertoire. They need to know what's effective to come back to the classrooms. And number three was help with their own language proficiency. They haven't used it in a while. Right? And so all of this is about what we need to do in terms of teacher preparation and as well as bringing these teachers back. So what we did with that knowledge is we did go to the legislature and we did get $5 million in the state budget to fund 8 grantees who are to be working with those teachers, bilingual teachers, sitting in English classrooms, and then the bilingual teachers who haven't had their certification to get them ready to come to our bilingual classrooms. Now, what we're finding, which parallels what Magali was talking about, with those programs is the content of what is being delivered by those 8 grantees is from A to Z, right? There is no cohesion, no consensus, no set of common understandings, right? And had we had a framework in the proposal that people would use, that would be interesting to see how people are using this kind of a framework and the lens that Magali is proposing with these teachers to bring them back into the programs. And that is something I think we need to think about in terms of teacher preparation and about working with teachers who are currently in our programs. And I have to say, I always marvel at the work that Magali Center and her colleagues do because they are so rooted in practice as well as research that the work that they do on several of their projects really does produce the kinds of teachers and the kind of critical consciousness we want teachers to have when they teach. So some of the examples that I think for us to learn from their work, they have this journalism program, which is an after-school program, where students' voice, they become literally reporters. They go out in the field, they do interviews, they produce articles, and then the district literally produces a paper that gets distributed throughout the district, right? Now, you can all say what elements are there, but a lot of the elements that everybody's talked about here is in that project, right? So another one. We got, as Californians together, quite a bit of funding now. We're to do educator support for immigrant and refugee students. And we decided that what we wanted to do was really help teachers to address the students in their classrooms. Because we'd heard so many stories about kids crying, coming to school stressed out, worried their mother wasn't going to be there, where they were going to go, their house. Patricia's done an incredible study on that we've used. And so what we decided was we wanted to put in the hands of teachers lessons so those conversations could take place in the classroom, right? And so the first set of lessons, and we teamed with, again, Magali Center, was on family separation. And we found literature books that speak to that. So we have lessons for K-2, 3-5, and 9-12. They're all standards-based. They're all, but what we're having teachers do when they bring that into their classrooms and how they're doing it through the kinds of sophisticated instructional practices is really very moving. When our grant was to do 2 trainings, 1 north and 1 south, and we have now done over 18 because of the requests across the state. And so we're hoping that that kind of work the teachers are doing will hopefully influence maybe what they're doing in other parts of the time of their instruction, right? So those are just some examples of the kind of work that I think for teacher preparation that we need to make more systematic. We need to make it more the norm, not the anomaly, right, in terms of teacher preparation. And then the last thing I want to say is that I would hope, and Magali said this also, the advocacy-oriented researchers. We have a real dichotomy in, I'll say in California, you may have it in your states too, that researchers who do advocacy are not looked upon as real researchers, right? And for years and years, we would call upon Patricia, and she goes, you know, I don't know if I can really do that because I really don't want, I have to have my position as a researcher, right? But she's given that up. She doesn't say that anymore. No, she doesn't say that anymore. But honestly, the researchers who partner with us are not considered in many circles as real researchers, you know, as authentic researchers, right? They're just doing that policy stuff, right? And I think we all have to be advocacy-oriented researchers if we're going to move this agenda. So I want to give you an example of that, too. And, you know, there's been a lot of research about reclassification, and we in California are going to be in a huge argument about reclassification this coming year. Huge. And California has 4 elements of our reclass criteria right now. We have the English proficiency threshold, we have an academic threshold, we have teacher input, and we have parent consultation. So the thrust is to have just one element, the English proficiency assessment, right? Which you all do most, that's what it is in most of the other states. It's just the English proficiency, right? Well, we're worried about that, you know? The advocates are worried about that. And we have a new English proficiency assessment. It's only been given once. We don't have a lot of results from it, right? We don't know if it really does take into account whether students have the full breadth of language and academic competency from that assessment. But that's going to be the proposal. And before that test was ever administered, and pardon, I apologize to some of you because I don't remember the 20 names that were on this letter, 20 researchers signed a letter and sent it to our state board and our legislators saying, you don't need an academic measure. All you need is the language proficiency because the academics are holding kids back from mainstream classrooms, and keeping them in low-level English classrooms, on and on and on. Well, for us who are trying to make sure that we're not harming students by taking out the academic measure before we even see what the English language proficiency assessment was, wonder why those researchers were not talking to those of us who were doing this work in the area of policy to see what the impact of that letter has in terms of moving forward the agenda. And so I make a plea that in the area of teacher preparation, in the area of policy and program, that we find a way that we all do this work together and that research leads to policy that's good for kids and good for the adults that are in the system and not competing, right? So the other piece of research around reclass is that, you know, some of the research has said the earlier we classify the kids, the better they do, right? Well, at least in California, because we have the academic measure, if kids meet the academic measure early on, well, yeah, they're going to do well, right? They got language proficiency and they do well academically. It's not the earlier you do it, the better it is, right? So we don't have academic measures for K-1 and 2. I don't think anybody does. We just have the language proficiency assessment. So we've seen some We've seen some pilot run. We've seen some runs on last year's first administration, and 17% of all of our kindergarten kids could be reclassified using that one measure. Are you telling me that almost 1 out of 5 kindergartners, after 1 year of support for language, that they're ready to compete in an all-English setting with no support at all? That's what reclassification is, right? So we're very worried about that. And we're going to have to do some kind of study or some kind of deep dive into those kids, K-1 and 2, to see what it is that's appropriate for us to recommend in terms of policy with the revision of our reclass criteria. And so research saying earlier the better is interesting, but the interpretation of that is really very, very difficult. And so all I can say is that we are so thirsty for your work, to be able to work with you on it so that policy is informed by what you all do, as we have done with Magali and the staff at her center. We do that work together always, and with Patricia too. Now, we ruined her reputation, I'm sorry about that. but for us, there are, you know, people who we have to count on. We have to count on you, because it's hard for us to stand up and advocate for the kids when we don't have the kind of data that we need to have to make the case, and especially when people think they have data to not make the case, right, that's damaging. So it's a thrill to be here in the presence of all of you, and it's great to be able to do this work, and we look forward to continuing that conversation. Thank you. At lunch break, you'll all be able to get a copy of the study.
Okay, I have a couple of comments to make before we open to questions. I'm going to try not to get in trouble, but I always get in trouble because I have no filter, and I am retired now. So, I am not a researcher, and I want to bring it back to the practitioner, because I work at a state agency, and I was involved in licensing and creating endorsements and all that kind of stuff. And I think why we need to remember that all 50 states basically do their own licensing. So when teachers cross borders and teacher preparation, guess what? Licensing and credentials do not. And that's very important for us to remember when we're talking about, you know, teacher preparation, why we even have ongoing professional development. How portable is it? How well does it play in other states? I look around the audience, it's obviously heavy California, and you know, we realize how bountiful California is with resources and wonderful weather. But you know, a lot of states are not that blessed. And I think we have to remember, when we have good teacher preparation programs, we need to make whatever we're doing there portable so they can't get licensing in their own state. The other thing is, ongoing professional development is so important. Because of the teacher shortage, we have all kinds of things going on with temporary authorizations, alternative route to licensure. We have an onslaught of foreign teachers being brought in that maybe don't understand the American classroom, but we still need to be able to provide, you know, some kind of support for them, because that's the reality of it. Right now, state agencies are desperate for teachers. They're lowering standards, unfortunately. They're bringing in foreign teachers because of the shortage, and we need to figure out a way to raise the bar on whatever we're doing so we do provide a better quality instruction in the classroom, because it really does come down to that teacher-student interaction and what is going on in the classroom. So that's what I would like to add. As I said, there's at least 15 different states represented. I kind of counted it around, and knowing where people come from. So we'd like, when the questions, open it up to what is the experience going on in your state with teacher preparation programs, and what are you experiencing ongoing professional development? So there it goes. Yes?
So I'm not as well-versed as all of you, and I'm very humbled to be here. But I do have a lot of experience with Texas preparation program. In 2005, I was asked to work with the state of Texas on revising some of their language proficiency assessments. And I noticed then that the language proficiency exam was based only on the Spanish proficiency, not on the pedagogical side for the teachers. So that's one of the reasons why it motivated me to go back to school and go into the dark side of psychometrics. And I wanted to analyze a little bit, you know, what was it that the state was doing and why was it so difficult for teachers to become certified? Well, it turns out that the state of Texas does not publicly shows the data of the attrition of our bilingual teachers, or it has never been requested. So I embarked on this long and painful journey to receive this data. And the analysis of the data, it turns out that Texas teachers, the attrition of our teachers is twice as much as the national average of attrition of teachers. So then I wanted to look and see, why is that? And when I interview and I visit many districts across the state, and many teachers, and being a practitioner myself for over 15 years, knowingly that I was known as a language competency. I have 5 certifications in the state of Texas, but not because I'm wonderful. It's because they always moved me whenever they needed me. So in order for me to be eligible to teach, I had to take the certification exams. So my experience between K-12 and special education led me to believe that there was something really wrong with what we were doing in the assessment of our preparation programs and teachers. So when I gathered the data and I analyzed the data about the attrition of bilingual teachers, I went back to the state and I asked to see how they develop the exam. Well, the exam at that point for teachers was solely, if you had the social component of the Spanish proficiency, you can get the certification. So for alternative certification teachers, that was possible. And furthermore, if a teacher didn't have the certification, they were allowed a year to work without certification until they passed the exam. Well, many teachers didn't have the proficiency they needed to pass the certification exam, so they exit the profession. And so then I went back to the state of Texas and said, something's wrong with that exam. I need to look at it. Let me look at it. And so they combined a group of experts and they invited me in as a practitioner to revise the test. And I was looking and I was thinking, this will not work. This is not teacher. This doesn't work in the classroom. This is not related to the content our students are learning. This is not how we communicate with parents, you know. And so we developed another revised version of the exam that not only composites the language proficiency, but is in a classroom setting with pedagogical practice. It's very comprehensive. But guess what? After that was passed, and everybody was comfortable with that, we received a lot of negative comments from university preparation programs because they didn't believe that the test was a good test. Oh, many did not realize what was in the exam, what we were testing. And so TA designed a program to train teachers, and they asked me to lead this program. And so I trained over 500 teachers. And at that point, prior to testing this program, the passing score was 36%, so it was very low. But after the training, with the new format of the test and explaining to teachers what the proficiency really requires of them, with a pedagogical inclination, then we raised the passing score to 92%. So it really, sometimes I think that sometimes in higher preparation programs, and I am right now in one of them, and I talked to many colleagues, I don't know many of them that welcome the new test, welcome the high standards, but I truly believe from the results that we have seen, and one of my studies is being published now, talks about that. You know, that it's important to have those high standards, and the proficiency for bilingual teachers need to be across the continuum, not just language, you know, but that pedagogical aspect.
Comments? More comments? This is such a shock. Okay, and then Rhonda.
I have to speak to this. I want to add to your comments, and I had the privilege of speaking with you earlier and finding out about your motives for what you did. I just want to say I'm moved by the fact that we're at the point where we're talking about the power of pedagogy. We have all these ideologies that we want to reflect in our programs, but when it comes to it, our children are mostly impacted by the 5 hours that they spend with their teachers in their classrooms. So their pedagogy about how they see themselves, how well they like achieving the language, they all boil down to that pedagogy. I also want to acknowledge the comment that has been made of the power of the need to connect what our teachers are experiencing in the field with what our universities are envisioning that is an adequate program, preparation program for our teachers to prepare to have that positive impact on children. To be very reflective and being ongoing, not a one-time thing. Because our needs in the classrooms are emerging, expanding, and taking us to new horizons as the very definition of the children that we serve in our programs is expanding and changing, as Rhonda alluded earlier. And then I want to say, as in my experience as a practitioner, training 500 teachers every year and working and collaborating with practitioners who are supervisors of language across the state, we recognize there is a huge need to think of the trajectory of our teachers as ongoing. Pre-service, initial support in the field, and then to grow their expertise to become models and to become mentors of newer teachers in the field. So I just have to say that because it's so strongly in my experience and in my heart, and I appreciate the comments and the work that has been done to bring those points out.
Rhonda, then John.
So thank you for all of these things. When Greg, when you first asked your question, I thought, okay, I was certified in 5 states, in the National Board Certification,
right.
Which one had the most rigorous, right? Like, make your head explode. So but I think there's one question that we're answering for, which is how do we get the state licensing to match the skills that are to be in bilingual classrooms? How do we get the teacher education programs to say, oh, this is what this, how the state license is changing, how do we start to change our pedagogies at the university level? And for many of our communities, those will solve the needs that we have around teacher certification, teacher shortage, teacher placements. In a state like Louisiana, where almost 100% of our teachers are still bringing in from other countries to teach in our dual programs, it doesn't solve our needs, right? And so in Louisiana, we solved a different thing, which was how do we extend visas and how do we extend more credentials locally for teachers who have international preparation, international degrees and experience. And that's a win for us, right? Because we get 6 to 10 years with teachers sometimes before we have to leave. But we're still missing so much of the conversation around equity and social justice, because the teachers that we bring in from other French-speaking countries or Spanish-speaking countries, they're coming from a majority perspective in their home country. Mm-hmm. And we're asking them to come into the United States and connect with, identify, further develop our youth who are growing up in minoritized experiences. And that is a fundamental place in which they have a difficulty connecting, right? They're like, I'm just experiencing discrimination for the first time now at 35. Mm-hmm. Well, great for you. However, our children are growing up with this right now. And so Lisa will do a lot of work with our teachers in St. Louis around this, like what is the history of racial discrimination, of education discrimination, of education access, and denial of education equity in this country, so our international teachers can start to understand it. But I think nationally we need to figure out some ways beyond the certification piece, particularly for states and communities that rely on internationally trained teachers, on how we help them bridge for this work of social justice and equity and compassion to their kids.
Great. John?
So just briefly, first, I'm so grateful for the work that you've done in the fields that you've dedicated your professional lives to. As a practitioner, I'm not as pragmatic as you get. Like, I spend my day going through health textbooks from Quebec to make sure there are no Native kids in there. I mean, that's the knowledge that you are out there fighting these fights, and that I can lean on you. There's no way for me to just say how humble and grateful I am. I'd like to step back, and there's two things that really struck me. One was this, the story that you told about the agency, this, the agency that was placed on the social studies students, and how those students really helped to change policy. There's also one research question that I'm kind of interested in, and that is, why does a student who's in middle school and high school decide to become a bilingual education teacher? I want to get you more students. I want to greatly increase the number of students you have in your programs. So I kind of just guess on a day-to-day basis. And we take a look at what's going on in our district. We put some things in place. We've got this system in place now where we have two schools we've identified that through their career technical education programs have teaching as profession programs. We have worked with a university through a grant program to rent a bus to ferry those students from the high school back to the elementary school so that they can volunteer with these students during the day. Talk about a group of kids that are social justice minded. I mean, my God, we fix all this by getting all of these middle school kids to become teachers. So I'm kind of curious to know what more we can do to connect these programs that we have in our schools. I mean, literally, I think we have to start in middle school. Because one of the problems, in my opinion, in public education is, if you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer, your mom or your daddy probably told you you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. Very few teachers are telling their kids, you got to go be a teacher. And for a lot of these students, they're not coming from a background where they had parents who were highly educated. No one is stopping the 12-year-old in the building and saying, good God, please, go be a dual language immersion teacher. So I'm trying to do more of that. So I could use some help, I guess, or just a partner in helping me to understand what it is with these students, what helps to get them motivated to do this, and how I can get them better into your programs. Because I'm so excited that, you know, in California, you have this wonderful, this article is terrific, about how you're creating a space for these former bilingual education teachers into DLI. I'm like, that's great. I'm sitting outside Atlanta, and I don't even know if I'm allowed to say the word bilingual. I'm not sure that's legal in my state. So we are functioning in a different idiom. But I think there's something there. So thank you. I'm done.
Hey, Shelley, then Anna.
So, you know, 35 states now have the state seal of biliteracy, recognizing high school students who are bilingual and biliterate, and I know there was some comment about the level of their bilingualism and biliteracy, but we in California now have awarded 231,000 plus students with that seal. If we only had a recruitment campaign for 5% of them, 5% of them, 10% of them, we would have no shortage. They speak 49 languages. They have been recognized in speaking 49 languages. I mean, the crisis would be over. We just need a recruitment campaign, right? To take those kids and pull them into teacher education. And as you said, make teaching their future. You know, talking to them about making teaching their future. And the CTE money that keeps going out from the federal government, if there were teacher CTE programs and an incentive for bilingual teacher CTE programs, that would be another way of doing it. But I mean, we have pools. We just have to go for them, right?
Great. Anna, you're next, and then you're after.
Okay, I wanted to say that in California, after Prop 58 passed, us in higher ed, we thought we were going to have a pool of people knocking at our doors wanting to become bilingual teachers. That's not the case. And I'll tell you what, I've been around campus, down at the sociology department, at the history department, at the science department, trying to recruit students into school of education. Here's what our students are telling us. We were never treated fairly in schools. Why do we want to go back to that institution that was so unfair to us? So they're looking for other ways of using their assets in other communities and in other institutions, and it's not education. So I think we need to own up where we are because of the way we've treated our students in our schools. Now they don't want to come back. And it's really sad.
So can I connect the dots a little bit between the conversation? And one of it is about where is the teacher pipeline and where do we begin? And, you know, there's a lot of paths. I'm talking about genealogy. There is a genealogy of looking at bilingual teacher shortage and demand in this country that we also need to look at who are potential sources. In the context piece, talk about what are the views of teachers and these approaches to teacher preparation. Those are the students that Anna's talking about that were exposed to teachers who were technicians, who delivered technical manuals for reading, developed literacy in a very scripted approach. So they were turned off to school, so no wonder. Mm-hmm. So I think we had to go back and look about schooling writ large. What kind of schooling? A lot of the papers here have talked about not just for GLI, but schooling at large. And change was happening in general education and general teacher preparation so that we can have better student perspectives and views of what it means to become a teacher and what it means to be a teacher. And the second is that there's other sources that we know from the literature that are from the communities. The Grow Your Own programs that were mentioned in one of our discussions yesterday, that's very historically bounded in recruiting from the community and recruiting from non-traditional community members that can come into the teacher workforce as a paraprofessional. That's another source. Have them come into the school to support and work in collaboration with teachers. That implies more professional development because we haven't had the funding to be able to increase the number of paraeducators. They were eliminated in our economic crisis. So I think that we can explore some of the remedies to the shortage in different ways by learning.
All right, we have about 10 people now want to speak. So this is like quite the conversation. And you, then you, and then you, and then you.
You.
All right, let's go. This is exciting.
Yeah,
you're
first.
Francesca,
I'm going first.
Would you like to say your name before I don't take this, please?
Francesca. I think what we're hearing, and I think as we do this work on dual language, what we all, because it's more than just the state of California represented here and who's doing the work on dual language, is, and Magali, I really appreciate you talk about the professionalization, but we have to be cognizant of the really huge force of deprofessionalizing teaching. I mean, you look across the nation, and being in the state of Arizona, we had Red for Ed with a Koch-funded governor who put two additional Supreme Court justices so that when the Red for Ed initiative went on the ballots, they got it off. So we are in a context, in the schools where I work, 3,000 vacancies. We have Grow Your Own, but with the economic crisis, our tuition doubled. If we're trying to go to these marginalized communities and recruit teachers, and suddenly they're burdened with loans because we don't have the funding at the institutional level to support them, getting into debt, Arizona has the lowest salaries, by the way, once you look at cost of living, it's not sustainable. They have to take on extra jobs. So I think it's very important for us when we're trying to maintain these high standards of professionalization, what context are we in, and all the forces working against that. We need to know that, right? Because it's a bigger picture.
Great.
And actually, this is very connected to that, Lucrecia, again. I think that, Magali, when you were saying about the teacher pipeline and where it is, I think we need to recognize that those sources of potential teachers are also located in an environment that's incredibly segregated. So not all of the vacancies are going to be sort of spread out uniformly across the state. And just one data point to add to that, in the study we did in Pasadena, we actually got the zip codes where all the dual language and non-dual language immersion teachers in Pasadena worked. And the average commute for the non-dual language immersion teachers was 9 miles. The average commute for the dual language immersion teachers was 18 miles. They're not coming from there. They're coming from all over the county, and they're going back to the compensation, Shelley, which, you know, we heard, I'm sure this is in all the, you know, several of the papers, the lack of materials, do your own worksheets, all of that. So when we interview the non-dual language, they don't want to become dual language. They've seen it, as you said. And the compensation, you know, we actually mapped this. And it was interesting because they were earning about, at that time, $46,000 initial entry salary for a teacher, any teacher, and they were driving in these 18 miles through districts that were paying 50, 55, 58. Yeah. So it creates this internal labor market when everyone's competing with each other, but it has nuances in terms of not just the working conditions and the job demands, but also how spread out it is regionally.
You know, eighteen miles in Los Angeles is
not extra hours.
Over here, then Michael's on deck and Deborah's in the hole. That's a baseball terminology.
Yeah, I just wanted to share that I've done some work with my colleague here, Ana Hernandez, on just looking at who are these teachers, who are the people that are coming to our programs. And so we've come up with 22 typologies and growing as to what the backgrounds are of these teachers. So that's an article that's forthcoming. It's under review right now. So I just wanted to share that because I think we need to know who are the ones that actually make it in the door and what is it that gets them there. So that's the study that we've conducted. But I also wanted to share that, you know, there is some good news in the horizon. Yeah. One of the things that we did this year, and it was stemmed from the work that you, the research that you did, Shelley, on trying to find out, like, where are the paraprofessionals, where are those people that are in the shadows, basically, that are invisible. Mm-hmm. So this year, we did some major recruitment in migrant communities, mm-hmm. and we have 60 right now from all over the state. People that are, and they call themselves, we have been in the shadows, and now you have brought us out. So we are right now, they should be finishing this, it's a one-year program for them, so we have to do a lot of online, it's within the state. So so anyway, just looking at different ways that we can really, first of all, understand who these students are, their psychologies, their backgrounds, and then reaching out to those communities that really become invisible. And one of them is a little bit of work that I'm doing with Patricia, is also looking at how do we prepare teachers for the students that we share across the year. So that's just another piece of it that we hopefully very soon will be able to share about what we're doing with that. But there are so many complex, you know, areas in teacher development. You know, just as we think like, okay, here's a framework, this is what we need to do. It's that, well, you know what, there's another community, there's another aspect, and there's another political, socio-political situation. So I'm very appreciative that we're here today to talk about this, because as we talk about dual language programs and how we can make them more equitable, we can't deny that the focus really needs to be on who are these teachers and how are we preparing them and how are we reaching out to them.
Okay, great. We have our leader making a comment, then we'll have Michael, then we'll have Deborah. We might be out of time. If not, if we have any time left, it's to you.
Just a factoid out there. We have 9,000 teachers in the workforce right now who are overwhelmingly bilingual teachers who have DACA. If we lose DACA, we lose 9,000 teachers out in our schools right now.
Well, that's a policy. I'm going to jump in. One of the policy briefs that I wrote with one of my colleagues talked about, given this federal political state that we're in, how can California, which is the third largest economy, right, push the teacher shortage, fifth largest economy? Thank you.
Actually, six. Depends.
No, we just passed. We just passed somebody.
It's usually how it goes.
Okay, let's go. Michael wants to say something, then Deborah will be out of time. Okay. Are we out of time?
Yeah, I have four people right underneath that are DACA. We're going to lose them. And critical.
Speak up.
That's not what I was going to talk about. It was about 3.5 years ago, we started the school year 14 dual language teachers short. Mm-hmm. And we have pushed dual language in the equity work. I know there are lots of complexities in all this. But here we are. The naysayers, of course, that just empowered the naysayers in my arena, saying, oh, you can't find the teachers. You got to stop this program. And so forth. So this was not just a Portland Public Schools, but it was a woe is me and state level ran around fighting this is the number one issue across the district or across the state. And knowing that our teacher education programs are not producing the teachers that we needed, we decided that we needed to, we were going to be able to crisis that started our Grow Your Own. And when we stepped back and sort of thought about it and looked around and said that there was a lot of people right underneath our noses that were bilingual, educated, know their communities and look and speak like the kids in our communities. So we started our own with a partnership with a university to be able to do that. But what we realized is that what is preventing a lot of them from coming in the first place, even though they were interested, was that there were institutional, cultural, and financial barriers that were preventing them from stepping through. So we decided our primary goal was to, for equity, it was to break down barriers into, because they were being asked to stop their job for a whole year, pay $35,000 to the university in hopes of getting a job. So instead of saying that, we said, like, look, we couldn't come up with that kind of tuition, but we could break down everything from application fees to getting their transcripts translated if that was necessary, to evaluated, to test fees, and instead of having to just go take the civil rights test because they didn't grow up here or they weren't in that mainstream white culture, that we needed to actually provide the scaffolding and support, how do you do interviews, all those things to set them up for success, walking through that process, and then getting into the system, and then having a job for them so that they can be paid through that system. And I would say that we've done a lot of stumbling. We have 53 people now that are in that, and actually we've lost almost virtually very, very few of them. As we did that, the most important thing that has been for us is to have an outside critical thought partner who's provided us very intense feedback and data, and sometimes it's hurt because we've heard some things that we didn't want to hear, we thought we were pretty good at. But I would say the Northwest Regional Educational Lab was really critical, and critical of our PSU, our partner as well, what we need to do different for to keep our dual language teachers, our bilingual teachers in the profession. And so I put that out there as one of the things that we came to is that, is like when I talked to Dr. Richard Ingersoll at University of Pennsylvania and sort of say, you know, the problem that we have, recruitment, you're always going to need to recruit and so forth, but the problem, the bigger problem is the leaky bucket, and we're losing these folks, and bilingual teachers is one of the greatest ones that's losing them all the time. And I said, well, so what are the three things? Like, what can we do to change this? And he said, mentorship, practice. We've assigned mentors with these folks for the 2-3 years that are bilingual DLI experienced teachers. We do now lab classrooms in the summer to really get them practice. But he said probably the most important thing, at least from his perspective and what he saw in the research, was teacher empowerment. And I think about all the conversations we're having about, you know, that critical consciousness and thinking that's the empowerment. So we start our dual language institutes in the summer with the first 2 days are all about social justice and why, developing your own sense of why and why you're in DLI. And I think that it's always a learning process, but I just think about we invested in our local community people. They're not going to move away. We've gotten into the habit of importing teachers, and that was not working. It was evolving more, and they weren't really reflective of the kids in our communities. So I just think about how, and I know this works in our context, Pacific Northwest, maybe because we have, you know, those people in our community, of course, but I just think about how do we do those things as a practitioner? How do we do those on a regular basis and work collaboratively with our researchers and our teacher preparation people in the university? And I would say one of the great things has been a partner, is the partnership that we have with the university is not as a top-down telling us what to do, but it's actually as a partnership that they're learning from us as practitioners and we're learning from them as the people that are trained. So, you know, I just share that as another way to approach.
Great. Yep.
Great. So, preparing teachers for dual language immersion, that was an interesting proposition to me. Is it different from preparing bilingual teachers? really what it's worth asking. Of course, there's a difference between teachers who are bilingual certified teachers, and teachers who work in bilingual programs or dual language programs. So it made me wonder, we're kind of blurring terms. Maybe that ought to be on the list of the terms that we want to try to agree on. Because we want to know not just what we're calling our kids, but what we're calling our teachers and what we're calling our programs. Because here we were asked just to talk about dual language immersion, just about two-way, really. And most of our emergent bilingual kids aren't in two-way. So we're actually preparing bilingual teachers to work with all bilingual kids. And that's what we're talking about. That's what Magadi talked about. Because that's, you know, that's a broader definition. Most of our bilingual teachers in California are currently not in bilingual programs. But they're working with bilingual kids. And that's actually, in my mind, that's kind of our larger goal. We're here to support bilingualism, bilingual children, success for bilingual kids, and kids who are members of language minoritized communities. So I think we just have to try to sort of tease out those distinctions. And also, thinking about the teacher shortage, I have to voice a concern that my Kathy Escamilla, my colleague at CU Boulder, mentioned to me as I was kind of on my way out the door to come here. She's very angry about two-way dual language because half the seats in those programs are going to non-emergent bilingual kids. And with our teacher shortage, that's irresponsible. That was kind of her comment. So bring that to the group, she says. So I did.
Okay, back there.
I want to address a few perspectives. First, as the emergency credentialed teacher who is now sitting here with you, so I just ask you to caution when we think about teacher prep, that there are people who are coming into the rooms at many different levels and wanting to learn and be educated of all of the pieces. And I say that because if I didn't have that opportunity and window, I wouldn't have had certain experiences. Luckily, I was surrounded by mentors at my school site. Not at the district level, at my school site, who supported me around thematic teaching, when we could do that. But I want to say something about that. There was a time, you can throw darts at me, that we did need a prescriptive program because I was never taught in my university program that had very good intentions how to teach a child how to read. I did not know how to do that. And I want to be very honest about that. So learning that, infusing on the layer of what I understood of thematic teaching at that time, right? So building, in the Title VII programs we were involved with. Leading to now, in my former role as the HR director of recruitment a few years ago, and also discipline and dismissal, every principal wants the best teacher for their children in the classroom. I would make a choice, I'm being very vulnerable right now, that a bilingual teacher with a bilingual authorization over a teacher who has heart, listens to the community, may not have the bilingual authorization, who would provide the best service for my students and the community they serve. So I want you to just think about those pieces when we language all of this out. The next thing is, when I was looking at the teacher shortage and recruitment and all those different pieces, everyone was pushing, because it's valid, we have a special ed crisis, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have enough teachers with the credentials, and we don't pay them enough either.
Right.
Add the bilingual layer on top of that, especially in LA Unified, in terms of what our kids need. We had to, at the time, we reinvented our career ladder program because all the funding was pulled out. And one of the things I had to push in a small way for people to listen is, hold on. I'm hearing about Prop 58. I'm hearing about these other things coming. Fine, we're going to do our career ladder, we're going to find our special ed trainees or our classified employees. We need to build, and I had to fight for about $50,000 to find and start with about 12 TAs to fund them for 4 years, $4,000 a year to help support their tuition. So there's ways to do it. But sometimes we all get stuck in this box. This is where the teacher shortage is, without looking at the additional teacher shortages. And it's interesting because I'm wondering about the survey that was conducted, Shelley, and I don't know how LA participated in it because I may not have been in HR at the time.
No, LA
all the districts are anonymous, but LA participated.
Okay.
It's the ones with 700.
So, and I'm curious to have a conversation with you about who was pulled into that dialogue, because I haven't been in that role for a while. So I'm listening to all these pieces, and I choose to be in a room that I assume everyone here is very open to the vulnerabilities of who we are in different arenas. And I'm going to go to the next level in terms of the seal of biliteracy and the access that we have to our students, because we had 3,792 kids receive a seal of biliteracy in LAUSD. Phenomenal, right? Our union partners are advocating for exactly what you're saying, but then the issue becomes, where does the money go at a higher political level?
Right.
And who are we paying for what? So the practitioner piece, the story piece, and the research piece, how do we keep aligning all of these? And we need the rigor in our teacher programs, I agree, but we also need to open the door for those students who did not participate in a bilingual program, who want to develop their bilingualism and want to give it also back to the community, to have a pathway in so that we can continue to support them as they're part of our community.
Okay, we have 3 minutes left. Lisa wants something, and I'm going to turn it back to Magali and Shelley for closing words.
Yeah. This is really quick, so I think there'll be time for you. I just wanted to say, from Missouri, we just can't forget those states that have nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely nothing in terms of teacher certification and preparation for any of the three categories that Deb mentioned. We do have TESOL, but TESOL, and then we do have, we do have dual language programs, though. And so we have schools and districts that are trying to figure out, I'm not sure what's the best thing. Is it an elementary teacher? Is it a K-12 foreign language certified teacher? Is it TESOL, or is it someone that hopefully has all of that? So, yeah, go.
I'm in the linguistics department, I'm foreign and languages department. I'm struck by the absence of a discussion of languages departments with students who are studying foreign languages. I shouldn't say foreign languages, studying languages. And we're not looking at languages department as a potential pipeline. And why is that? Because when the language departments look at the cost of education and what it will take for those students to get a certificate, we can't have students in the degree program for 6 years adding all these requirements on top of their language major that they already have. There's no conversation. We talk about institutional barriers. That's a huge
one
between
yeah.
the humanities
yeah.
and
true.
The language departments and the education. Our professors in languages tell their students not to even consider teaching. One is the salary, the other is time to degree. So I just want to say, if there is some way for all of you to start a conversation with the departments and programs at universities that has tons and tons of students studying languages, something has to happen to make that possible for the students to complete the degrees and move on.
Okay, back to you, and then we're done. It's Anne, but do you want to say two words? You can say two closing words. It's up to you.
I just think that it's opened the door, this conversation's opened the door about how complex bilingual teacher preparation is and what we can do together to move the research and the policy. The financial issue is part of it. I think we're going to talk about philanthropy later. And it was mentioned that one of those research partnership practices, you didn't say it that way, the Portland Department of Ed person, I can't remember your name.
Michael,
thank you. It's really, it's collaborative.
He's not a state
that are really important. But I'm
definitely
talking about
it. Let's see.
I was listening
about
that.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Quick.
Continue over lunch.
All right. Or thank you so much. Wonderful presentation. Great. Thank you.
Are you Leah? Yeah.
Happy
holidays.
Yeah.
Sure. whole other world. So it's
You're all the best. You're all the best.